From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when a woman named Vicky hit a wall, so to speak. At age 61, Vicky was doing everything she could to try to lighten the load of a friend facing a terminal illness. During that time, she was also caring for her parents as they were ill and dying. She told her friend Stephen that she felt weighed down, tired, and sad all the time. She said she asked herself, how much more could I do without getting even more tired and sad? Vicky was struggling with something called compassion fatigue. The term refers to a deep emotional and physical exhaustion or burnout that comes from caring for others who are experiencing significant emotional or physical distress. It's common among medical practitioners, emergency responders, and sometimes people like Vicky who are caring for friends or loved ones. Stephen wrote about Vicky's experience in a column for the Washington Post titled, "Compassion Fatigue Hits Not Only Professional Caregivers, Other People Get It Too." The symptoms of compassion fatigue can include apathy, anger, isolation, and of course, fatigue, and it makes it difficult for people struggling with compassion fatigue to empathize with the people they are trying to help. It can lead to desensitization, a lack of patience, cynicism, and worse. So how can clinicians, police, and everyday caregivers protect themselves from compassion fatigue or work out of it when it has already set in? Shawnee Wilson is a physician assistant at a local healthcare practice, and she's leading trainings on how to recognize a condition and maybe reduce burnout. Well, this hour she helps us understand compassion fatigue from different angles and the impact it can have on those suffering from it. And I want to emphasize again, we're going to talk about police this hour. We'll talk about teachers and healthcare practitioners. But this can be, in some ways, all of us. And I think this is so important to understand this. So, Shawnee, it's great having you. Thank you.
Thanks for letting me be here with
you. And we kind of talked the last time you were in. It was one of those things where Shawnee just kind of grabbed me and said, you know, I've been working on this. And compassion fatigue was a term I had never heard before.
Right. Yes, it is. It's one of those things that has been passed around in certain circles, in certain professional circles. So this is a term as a physician assistant that I've actually heard quite a bit, even when I first started 5 years ago. But I've been noticing, and if you've noticed on Facebook, that there has been kind of a resurgence or just like a louder voice talking about physician burnout and physician compassion fatigue, or just like especially with everything that's going on right now nationally and with our healthcare crisis.
And so in some ways, as I think about the work you do as a physician assistant, we'll talk about how you might recognize in yourself when you're kind of overloaded.
Yeah.
But also, even for people who have to see a doctor or a physician assistant, a nurse, someone in a medical setting, and they feel like the care they got was not good or not caring. It was, you know, blunt or rough or difficult. Maybe you're recognizing that in other people, and you're sort of giving me a kind of this knowing nod.
Yeah.
I mean, has it been you? Have you hit a wall like that?
Oh,
before?
Yeah. So I think so. I work in a FQHC lookalike, and so that means that the most of the people that we take care of are those that have income inequality, or that they have low income, or that they have other healthcare disparities. So, or inner city. And so a lot of my patients usually do not have continuous access to care. They don't have a provider that follows them regularly, or they have a lot of chronic medical conditions that causes them to not seek adequate health care. A lot of it is too is just a lot of them bounce around from other practices, from practice to practice. And when I first started working at my first FQHC, when I was a grad, like when I just recently graduated, I was overloaded with patients. And by the time I started my very, like the first couple months, I was seeing probably, and I see, so a lot of times you'll see about like, I don't know, you're hoping for like maybe like 15 patients a day. I was seeing probably about 20. And that was as a new grad. And
that's a
really
lot.
Yeah. You know, the thing is, too, is that, you know, as a new grad, you're just going to be like, well, I'm not going to say no. You know, I want as much experience as possible. You know, in the practice I was in, I did feel like I had support, and I was lucky enough to work with people that really cared about me and seeing me grow as a provider. However, everybody was tired. you know, when they needed somebody else, they needed an extra person or extra body, if I can say that, to just see patients and to start processing their complaints and their chronic issues to get them healthier. And they're just, a lot of times, especially in primary care practices, there just isn't enough people. And so, you know, when you talk about patients coming to me or patients saying that they don't feel like they're adequately cared for, yeah. A lot of time it's not because we don't care as healthcare providers. It's just that, you know, there's been 13 different things that has happened before I've seen you in the last 5 minutes, or at least it seems that way. You know, I've had people that have, you know, that they're pulling you in three or four different directions. And then it's like, you know, you want to do the best you can for the patient at that time and say, listen, I'm listening to your problems. I'm here for you. But then you realize that, like, you know, you're getting a phone call. You forgot to send a message about another patient. You have a doctor's office calling you. You have a patient who, honestly, because we work in low-income healthcare, low-income practices, that one of your patients, they don't know where they are. You know, another patient is in a really severe domestic violence situation, and she needs help, you know, and her care manager is trying to call you, you know, and so you're doing three and four and five things, and you really do feel like the patient now, like, sitting in front of you is not getting the best care possible. And then you feel really bad about that. And then you feel really helpless about that. And then you start to talk about what you're talking about, compassion fatigue, where it's just like that detachment. Well, just the notion that if I could just have more time, then I could do better. Or how can I, you know, should I come to work earlier? And so you do, you start getting to work at like 6 a.m, 5 a.m, you know, trying to catch up on all of your charts and all of your, you know, medication refills and triages and all that other stuff. So it's a lot of it's a lot of vicious cycling. And a lot of times too, as primary care or medical providers in general, we're always constantly trying to strive to do better, but also trying to figure out how to make our lives easier.
As you continue your work in this field, eventually, do you expect that you will be working with, say, police departments? Training.
Yes.
I don't know, and I'm not going to ask specific cases. We'll talk a little bit about what we've seen in police incidents. Mm-hmm. But I don't know who Shani's clients are. I don't know if Brighton or RPD or the Monroe County Sheriff's Office have called. But those would seem to be appropriate organizations to train on. Here's what compassion fatigue is. It can hit, and here's what happens when. So that makes sense. So we'll talk about police. Mm-hmm. We're talking about healthcare providers. And I think, you know, when we think about teachers, we think about parents, you know, who are dealing with a lot of things. If a parent has ever had a sharp moment with a kid and then you find yourself going, man, why did I go off? Like, what was that? Why wasn't I showing actual empathy, or why was I responding this way? Sometimes it's a sign here. So let's talk about when compassion fatigue can actually do real harm to a person experience it. What are some of the possible impacts if someone is suffering from compassion fatigue?
So as far as like impacts on the individual?
Yeah.
So you start to, I would say, like, as far as warning signs go, at least to start there, you start to feel exhausted. You just lose your energy. You don't have any energy, if I can put it in quotes, to do anything. Start to experience disturbed sleep and also flu-like symptoms. Like, you start having back pain, you start having headaches, just ongoing fatigue that just doesn't get better. A lot of times you have difficulty concentrating, or there's just too many things for you to concentrate on, and so you can't focus on one thing, or at least it feels that way. You aren't meeting deadlines at work consistently, and they actually start getting more where it was like, oh, I'm not meeting a deadline, you know, this week, but now it's like 4 days in a row you're not really feeling like you're productive or getting anything done. You feel irritated and frustrated, and you become increasingly more self-critical. And a lot of places where you used to, find solace or, you know, like frequency as far as like doing things that you really like to do, all of a sudden they just irritate you and you just don't really want to be bothered with anybody or anything, because there's the need to just like retreat into yourself, to just calm down. You're just like, I need to calm down. I need to self-soothe and just sit down in a quiet space. So
can depression happen?
Yes. So as you can tell, that those are all signs and symptoms of depression also. And so a lot of times with compassion fatigue, it's really, I always like to call it like the flu symptoms before the flu starts. or the cold symptoms before the flu starts, or something along those lines. Like, these are real warning signs that there's really something a lot deeper going on that needs to be addressed.
Is there an effective way to try to get ahead of it, or to see it happening, and at least try to mitigate what's going on?
So that's a great question. I think that's a really big question, I think, because there's a lot of different ways to go about it. I think on the provider level, or on the healthcare professional level, police level, you know, some of these, or people that are working day-to-day jobs where they're stressed out and overwhelmed, that it is my belief that the organizations that work with these folks need to take actual responsibility into the health and well-being of their employees. Because, you know, a lot of the research is showing that if you have a place that compassion fatigue is increased when the employees feel increasingly hopeless about their jobs, which I'll give you an example, like a social worker. So a social worker will have probably about like 30 to 50 people on their caseload. And it depends on, you know, as we know in this, especially in this county, that we have a lot of serious cases going on as far as like patient need. You know, the patient needs are younger, they're more complex. The patients, you can't find them as often. So it's a lot of work goes into all of those folks. And so when you realize that, even if it has nothing to do with what the social worker is doing in order to do the best job that they can for the patient or for the client, it is all these unseen or factors that they don't have control over, which is, you know, I can't find my client. I can't get my client in to see DSS on time. I can't get them the appropriate furniture they need. Or it's just taking me so long to do everything that my client loses interest, or I just get bogged down with other work. And so if there's not stuff put in place to actually make things easier for the social worker or for the other workers in the groups that they're in, then it just really gets difficult and people start to get just inwardly fatigued.
Now, I think when we talk about what to do if you start to feel this way, or an organization supporting workers, whether it's police officers, people in the medical setting, whatever the case may be, we as a society still haven't probably come to any kind of a consensus on even something as simple as a mental health day. I saw on social media, somebody was posting about, and I don't remember where, some local school that is now allowing students to take mental health days and basically just avoid classes. And sort of predictably, the comments and the reactions were split. Some were like saying, it's about time, that's respecting mental health. Mental health is health. Mm-hmm. And then there was sort of the other predictable range of comments, which was students are going to abuse this. This is a school district going soft. We don't teach resilience anymore.
Right.
All of those things. And so you winced a little at that.
Yeah.
You're wincing at that.
I think the issue of resilience is what I wince at. Because, you know, how are we supposed to build resilience in ourselves if we don't have the chance and opportunity to do that? You know, we are responsible in a lot of ways for our own resilience. We are responsible for our own self-care. And that's why I'm saying, like, if we, you know, especially in those instances with the school district you talk about, I applaud them for what they've done. But I also think, too, it's that, you know, we have to allow ourselves and our students and teachers, and we have to allow ourselves to just kind of sit with ourselves and kind of, like, formulate our own ideas about who we are and what we need.
And so when it comes to what can be done to deal with the possible, and burnout's probably too broad word, though. I mean, it comes up sometimes even in clinical literature, which I'll get to in a moment. But if you're trying to get ahead of that and you say to an organization, say your employer, like, I need a day. I need a like, you find that appropriate?
Yeah. Yep. I think so. I think it's more than appropriate to need a day because I think on the individual level, you know, as far as like for healthcare providers, it's not the idea that you can't ask for a day. It's that the idea is that the question is, should you ask for a day?
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know,
absolutely.
Because the thing is, too, is like, you don't, you know, every company that I know of is like, of course you can have a day. But it's the point is the underlying culture. The underlying culture is that we are all doing, you know, the best work we can as fast as possible to get the best patient outcomes, but also to have, you know, the making the most money and et cetera and et cetera. And so you're like, should I take a day? Because I still have, you know, all these messages to answer.
Exactly. Or if you're a physician assistant, I don't know if you know anybody in this category, imagine you've worked a week straight or more. Yes. And imagine you are working, you're handling more patients than you probably know you should, but you're doing it because you know the need is there.
Right.
Staffing isn't necessarily there. The notion of taking a mental health day, then you start wrestling with, am I not there for the patients I need? How do I make up for the work? Am I going to get behind again? And then it starts this spiral that doesn't provide much mental health relief.
Right. That's right.
That's hard.
Well, the thing is, too, is essentially you are, and I think that it should also be said, too, is that you are still responsible for your own, for all of your own work, right? And so the work is going to be there regardless. And you know, we just have to get better about saying, like, voicing our own need for self-care. Because if not, just like in healthcare provider, police, you know, caregiving professions or help or caregivers, we all need to be able to just like use our voices and speak up. And that's the thing that I think if companies really are interested, that's the thing they need to empower.
Let me grab a phone call before we continue here. We're going to be talking in a moment about how this ties into the work of police officers. Emily in Rochester is first on the phone. Go ahead, Emily.
Hi, Shawnee. We know each other from our past.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm so glad you're on this program, and I really admire the work that you're doing in the community, and I'm following you, of course.
Thank you.
And I know you just mentioned about how, you know, how can organizations support not only healthcare workers? I mean, we're such a big community with healthcare and really strong organizations, but like what can we tangibly do to support our people that work in these caring professions or police work, you know, and how to get leadership too behind these self-care promotions, you know, because it's so desperately needed when there's, you know, punitive repercussions. If we don't see enough patients, monetary, you know, you get fined certain amounts. It's just crazy. The amount of pressure, as a nurse, you know, I see it. I've experienced compassion fatigue myself, and compassion fatigue can impact people's longevity in an organization, and that equates to you lose people, they go somewhere else, you know. It's just, there's a lot of factors involved, and I'm wondering what can we do to help get more buy-in on how to support people in these types of professions. So, and I can take my comment off the air.
Emily, thanks for the phone call.
Thanks.
Yeah, go ahead, Shawnee.
Yeah.
So I would say, Emily, I think that we need to have more of a broader conversation within our organizations about how important our jobs are. And I think just starting there with that global statement is like, my job is important to this agency. And if my well-being is important to this agency, and they go together, and that if you want me to be productive for you, then you're going to invest in my self-care. And I know that, you know, the idea of the self and the idea as the clinician, as the nurse, as the caregiver, as the police officer, they are not separated from each other. And so if you're going to care about what I do in my job, you should care about what I do outside of my job. And that means actually holding our people above us, our supervisors, directors, CEOs accountable as far as making sure that we get time off. And just, you know, I've heard some people say, which I in other professions, not like my own, that sometimes their employees will call them and be like, hey, are you working right now? You shouldn't be working right now. You should, you know, you're done for the day. And I just remember just gasping and just be like, oh my gosh, what? You know, that just sounds so great. And just that type of thing. Or like, should you be working right now? Send them an email and be like, okay, you're done for the day. And I would just be like, gasp and just hold my heart a little bit because that just sounds so great. So yes, greater accountability as far as within the higher ups to make sure that we're actually getting the time we need.
To be clear, if you're just joining us, what Shawnee Wilson is talking about is not just the kindness from employers to say, hey, you know, you've worked a long day, take the rest of the day. It's a recognition that compassion fatigue is real, And it can have real deleterious effects on the person who suffers from it, also on the people they work with and work for. Whether you are a physician assistant, a nurse, a doctor, a mental health caregiver in some way, whether you're a police officer, a teacher, a parent. So this isn't just about being a nice boss. I mean, this is about saying this is actually good for the organization, too, and recognizing that there is a real cost if compassion fatigue happens. Joanne in Scottsville is next on the phone. Go ahead, Joanne.
Oh, hi there. Great subject. Really appreciate it. I currently am in this cycle with an elderly family member of mine who's recently widowed. I'm trying to keep her home as long as possible. They didn't make some of the best decisions in their financials. So I have that. But the question that I have is, I am experiencing such a lack of empathy from other family members of mine and even some of my really close friends who are basically saying, you know, just throw her in a nursing home. And I mean, she may need assisted living, but we need to go through the process while she grieves and we make a long-term plan. But I find myself pulling away from people in my own family and friends who normally are people I would turn to for this stunning lack of empathy they even have. And I just didn't know if you had any advice on how to deal with some of those people who right now I'm pulling away from, and really it's making my own support circle so much smaller.
Yeah. So thank you so much for your question or for your statement. I think a lot, my advice would be to, you know, maybe it does sound like you do need to have a smaller circle of people that empathize with you.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of times too, it's like, I don't know your family dynamic or what's going on, but maybe they just don't have enough space right now to deal with what's happening. And it sounds like if you're the primary caregiver, then it sounds like you're the one that you are the center of the circle. And if you are not getting the support that you need from those with that are really having issues with a lack of empathy, then you really shouldn't be searching for empathy within those folks. And, you know, maybe they'll come around and actually get to a point where they'll be able to empathize a little bit better. But it sounds like, you know, if you're having compassion fatigue right now from other people's fatigue problems. And so it sounds like you really just need to just search out just some other folks that might be.
That's what I've been
doing.
That's very validating, and I appreciate it. Because,
yeah, definitely.
There is a whole lot of lack of empathy out there in general that's kind of stunning, too.
Exactly.
But people just want a quick answer. So appreciate your time. Thank you.
No problem. Thanks.
Thank you, Joanne. I'm going to read a comment that comes from an MD who asked me not to quote her name and says, "Oh my gosh, this is so my life right now. My eyes are welling up with tears. Lots of short staffing, overwork, people with unmeetable needs. I'm asked to do everything from arguing with RG&E to prevent people's electricity from being shut off, to arguing with insurers to cover inexpensive meds, to arguing for needed care. My patients are suffering from all of the systems you cover. Poverty, racism, PTSD, chronic illness. It's exhausting, and some days I feel as though my entire psyche has been scraped raw. I try to push this aside while I'm in the room with patients, but it's getting harder and harder. I know things are getting worse when I complain more. I can't stifle snarky comments. Yesterday, I threw my pager against the wall because I just didn't want to deal with a call." That comes from an MD.
Wow. Wow.
That's it, right?
Oh, my gosh. I'm tearing up a little bit. Yeah. I think, so just a side comment for that MD out there, I had a conversation with my dentist that I had actually had been, I had been leaving my dentist appointments, and they were going to kick me out because I kept going back to work. And not from the fault of my workplace, just to be clear, but just to the fact of, like, when I finally met with her, she, you know, we get together and talk about how overwhelmed we are. And that's not good.
So for the MD who sent that note, yeah, you want to be able to get together and talk with colleagues about how overwhelmed you are. And sometimes you have to vent.
Right.
But what else? I mean,
yes.
She recognizes it in herself, the way it's impacting her patients, the way she's doing her job.
Yes.
What's the next step here?
So I would say to her that, you know, it's time to start having conversations around how much you should be doing. And, you know, it's okay to have that conversation, you know, and it's so, you know, you need to give yourself permission to have that conversation. If you are at a point where you're throwing your pager up against the wall, the time is now, and it's okay to have it. You deserve it. and you've worked hard enough that you should be able to have that conversation and not be afraid. So do it. You deserve it, and you definitely need it. So,
listeners, we're talking about compassion fatigue, and as we get ready to go to break, I want to ask our guest, Shawnee Wilson, when you think about lines of work where you're most concerned about the impact of compassion fatigue, is there a short list that you're most concerned about?
Yep. So I would say, incidentally enough, I would say obviously healthcare providers, police department, and also the unsung heroes, like the woman who called on the phone, just regular caregivers in the community, people that are caring for their parents, people that are caring for their children, the people that are involved with the opioid crisis, family members that are dealing with kids that are going through depression and anxiety, you know, people trying to raise their kids, you know, people that are have gay and lesbian trans kids that are trying to help them navigate those spaces. You know, those are people that I'm really all concerned about. So,
and some of some in that list that you just heard from Shawnee comes directly from experience in your own line of work.
Mm-hmm.
So after our only break of the hour, we're going to talk about police officers. And this is obviously very important with police officers. And I think we should even put it right out there that no matter, you know, your view on how police community relations have been, whether it's in this city or across the country, we can agree that is a job that brings a lot of stress, tense moments, sometimes mental health calls, sometimes specialists, officers who are specializing in dealing with rape victims, mm-hmm. people who have been sexually assaulted. It can be very, very difficult for police officers. And compassion fatigue can impact them. It can impact the people that they are trying to serve in the community. And on the other side of the break, we're going to talk a little bit about how our guest views the work that officers do, what they ought to know. And I'll read a little bit from a study on the subject of compassion fatigue in police officers that we found. So we continue the discussion after this only break. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, Joe Biden says if he is the next president, cancer is going to be cured in his term. And he says the can-do spirit is going to lift America up and lead the way in cancer research. But realistically, what does the medical community say? It would be one of the biggest news stories in our lifetimes if it happened. We'll talk about cancer, research, the likelihood of cures on Wednesday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. My guest is Shawnee Wilson, a physician assistant at a local healthcare organization. And this was not something I planned to do, so I'm just asking this because I suspect people may be wondering. Are you available now to do trainings on compassion fatigue for organizations?
I am. Yes, I am.
I ask because, you know, we've gotten some powerful phone calls and emails already from people who are relating deeply to this and mm-hmm. probably would want to know what they can do about it, what employers can do. So if an organization, an individual, if they want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do it?
So I would say through my email, swilson9@gmail.com.
All right. swilson9@gmail.com. Shawnee is someone who leads trainings on how to recognize the condition and reduce burnout when it comes to compassion fatigue. Here's a study published in 2017 in a journal called Traumatology. And the study was titled Empathy, Compassion, Fatigue, and Burnout in Police Officers. And let me just quote from their findings. Quote, police officers are exposed to severely traumatic material. This study aimed to investigate whether specialist officers had developed compassion fatigue, secondary traumatic stress, and burnout, and whether these variables were associated with trait and situational empathy, an important factor in retaining victim involvement within the prosecution process. The study also piloted a brief training intervention aimed at educating officers about compassion fatigue and ways of reducing and preventing it. Cross-sectional analysis showed that longer-serving specialist officers had greater compassion fatigue, had greater secondary traumatic stress, and more burnout, end quote. Mm-hmm. Probably not a surprise. In other words, the findings confirm what you might suspect, which is that police officers who've served for a longer time tend to deal more often with compassion fatigue, feel it more deeply, feel that what we might call burnout, deal with secondary traumatic stress. How would you describe secondary traumatic stress, Shawnee?
So what I would say, there's a really good definition from Colleen Figley. She's a researcher out of California, and she really describes it as the emotional residue or strain of exposure. to working with those that are suffering from the consequences of traumatic events. And I really like that definition because it's the exposure, the strain, and just the residue of it. And it just stays with you and sticks to you.
So as we talk about police officers, let me open with kind of a broader question on whether you're a police officer or a physician assistant, a doctor, a teacher in a district that has high levels of poverty and trauma in the kids in class. Is it possible to avoid compassion fatigue altogether? I mean, eventually does it hit everyone?
I believe it does. I think because there's an essential like a thing I call about, like we talked about learned helplessness, you know, and we are constantly challenged with ideas or situations or words and rhetoric, especially in this country right now, that what we do sometimes and a lot of times doesn't matter. And I know people can argue with me about that, and I can definitely have that conversation with them, but I'm just putting it out there that a lot of times we are challenged with that notion, and it's really been really difficult to try to convince yourself otherwise or to say that, you know, that's not true, you know, this is what really works instead. But the whole process of figuring that out is really fatiguing, is really exhausting, especially when you really care about somebody or you care about your population or you care about your, the people around you, all of that.
So maybe, and I don't say this flippantly, more clinically, maybe the only people who could avoid it in those jobs in a long-term work setting would be someone who has psychopathy, who doesn't feel empathy, right? I mean, someone who actually cannot feel empathy for others.
Sure.
But that's not a large part of the population.
Definitely
and
not.
Most people with psychopathy don't end up in those jobs anyway.
Let's hope not.
So we're talking about most people. And so when it comes to police officers, if an organization calls you, emails you and says, come in and talk to us about compassion fatigue. We all need to know what it is, how it can impact us.
Mm-hmm.
Let me start with some questions that come to mind for me.
Sure.
What are you most worried about with police officers in this country and the impact of compassion fatigue?
So I would say, that's a great question. So I would say just the idea that there is a shorter reaction time to listening, if that makes sense. So I'll say it another way. Like if you're on a stop and instead if it was like, you know, I'll say like the change of shift, you know, if you've ever heard of that, like, you know, there's a change of shift time and the beginning of the shift versus your end of your shift. You know, the beginning of your shift, you're hopefully, you know, you've had your food, you're ready to go. The end of your shift, you're ready to get out of there. And if you have a really difficult call, you know, you're already tired from the day and you just want to go home. But if you already come, if you tack on compassion fatigue on top of that, it's just going to make you more irritable. Your inability to listen is going to be shorter and it's just going to be a more difficult time, which, you know, if you're dealing with the population might lead to poor outcomes or an outcome that you really don't want or a stop did not go the way that you wanted it to go.
I'm seeing an article shared by a retired officer who sends me this note. Here's an article on a New York Police Department officer dying by suicide, the seventh such death of an NYPD officer this year alone. Mm-hmm. And the retired officer says, compassion fatigue is especially acute when a police officer retires and it all crashes down. Suicide among retired officers is disproportionately higher than the general population. Years of dealing with tragedy built up after 30 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
Serious stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so if you can't avoid it entirely, if you go train a department, they might say, well, we've learned a lot today, but is there anything we can do? What do we need to be doing here? What should change in departments?
Yeah. So I would say one of the things that change in the department is, really starts up at the top, I honestly think. Because, you know, all of these things, like when you have organizations that have the need to control, to not give space and opportunity for self-care, to not give people the ability or the room to make positive decisions for their lives outside of their work, where it's constantly about work and about production and performance, or about perception from the community. And that's the stressor. then you are constantly going to have people that are stressed out, overwhelmed. And so really, especially with police, there is the idea of, you know, the older police officer or the police officer that's just been through it all. And it's just, they're idolized by their colleagues and their peers. And, you know, they're still out there. They're still doing what they need to do out there. But the idea that those folks are looked up to if they make the least bit of noise. And instead of it being like the norm where you have that person that is idolized for what they aren't doing and they're just making it work because that's what they do, why don't we just now have a conversation or have greater conversations within these police officer, these police departments where we are talking about having support groups for one another, or, you know, instead of having meeting with a psychologist that when you are having issues, meeting with a psychologist and having debriefs after calls, or just having an open session where people can go in and talk about a call if they've had a really bad call, or making it mandatory, you know, or having more screening opportunities for those that are really struggling. Because honestly, you know, people know when their friends are struggling. Police officers know when they have friends that are really not doing great, you know, and they'll chat about it just like I do in the healthcare professions. Oh, that person's really not doing really well right now. And you kind of shake your head and just watch them burn. Instead say, listen, I really want to make sure that you're talking with a psychologist. Why don't we schedule you an appointment? Or just like, you know, having a screening tool that says, you know, you really aren't doing very well with this specific call, or I'm seeing that you're increasingly irritable, you're not showing up on time for stuff, you know, is there something going on?
And yet I'm thinking of someone I know back in Ohio who is an officer, mm-hmm. who would, you know, and I say this with love and just understanding who this person is, would probably say, well, the notion of a debrief or having to talk about my feelings,
right,
is soft.
Right, exactly.
We signed up for this.
Exactly.
It's part of the job.
Right.
You want to dismantle the idea that it's soft?
I do want to dismantle that because, listen, you know, we aren't able to do our jobs effectively if that is the stance that we're going to take. And I understand because, you know, the culture of medicine is the same one in the same way, is that, you know, we idolize those that go before us that have this, you know, the mentality of, you know, just go all in and just be the best that you can be without making a sound, without just being that, like, that stable force, right? Because, you know, the idea of the stability being like the guy who's a solid rock, you know, and, you know, trying to disciple all these other younger guys is instead needs to be replaced with the idea of soft, like malleable, somebody that can be easily approachable, somebody that's like seeing that there's an issue with their friends and officers and instead leading to the right discussion in the right place. It does not do you any favors to not talk about what's going on, because then it's just going to show up in other ways, meaning increased, you know, suicide, people that are using drugs, you know, which is happening in some of these police departments around the country. So they are not immune, and we are not immune, so we really need to do a better job.
I want to reference an event that did happen in a high-profile way in Rochester, and I'm going to talk a little bit about it. I don't think it's fair to ask Shani to weigh in on this, but I'm just going to reference it because as I listen and learn in this conversation, my mind goes to wondering, was I witnessing a case of compassion fatigue? And that's the case of Christopher Pate. The police body cam videos were released about a month ago. And what you see in that 5 to 6 minutes of video, at least from my perspective, is an African-American man who police thought looked like a suspect in a crime that they were working on. Now, it turned out Christopher Pate was not that person, but he's just walking down the street. Officers approach him. The interactions to me spoke pretty quickly of a man who might have had either intense fear or some form of mental illness. He was repeating himself, he was scared, and what ended up resulting was the officers, at least one officer involved, getting very physical and violent with Christopher Pate. He was bleeding out of his face, he was tased, he was thrown in the back of the car, and the officer is yelling at him when he's in the car. I didn't want to have to do this. Yelling at Christopher Pate, you know, why did you make me do that? Why would you do that to me today? This is not an officer in that moment who was demonstrating, from my perspective, and I want to be careful and try to respect officers because I know the job is hard. I'm not sitting here saying, boy, police officer are all this or all that. But that officer, that was a shocking piece of video to watch for me. And now the more I learn about this, the more I think I may be looking at a case of compassion fatigue. This is an officer who just wasn't having it and wasn't going to try to work through what may be going on. It went straight to something pretty quickly that got violent. At the same time, though, Shani, whether that was or wasn't compassion fatigue, we have to have a system where everyone's accountable, right?
Right.
So if you're a police officer, you know, you got to be accountable. When you're called wherever wherever it is, you've got to do the job at a high level.
Right.
And I'm happy to say I think probably most police officers do, but in those moments, even if you've got compassion fatigue, that can't be an excuse if you're violent with someone in the community. How do we balance the need to be empathetic to a police officer, a teacher, a doctor, a physician assistant, with also saying if you are handling the people you're supposed to be working with in the community in a way that is unfair, destructive, or worse, that's not okay, even if I can have empathy that you may have compassion fatigue. Does that make sense?
Yep, definitely. So I think the first thing I think that needs to happen is that we really need to realize that those that are functioning in these high-level, high-stress positions, that if we are eventually sending them out, it's like sending somebody out without a bulletproof vest, you know? If we're asking folks to do this job, that they're putting their lives on the line every day, they're putting other people's lives on the line every day, you know, they're having to make quick decisions that can kill somebody, then we have to make sure that we are investing in them properly so that they can do their jobs. And also making sure that we are properly screening folks, that if they're having issues or shouldn't even be there on the job, that we are doing so and taking the step to say, no, we really need you to step back. You know, no, we really need to revisit what happened. And, you know, you need to tell us what happened, and we need to figure out why this happened. And, you know, and then maybe doing a better job of screening applicants to make sure that they're actually able to handle it. Because sometimes you go into something, you know, your childhood, your adult life, all of that stuff plays into who we are and how we relate to people. And so if you already are having issues with that, then you really shouldn't be doing that work. But also too, making sure that those people that are asking us to do this work also are accountable too, because they are.
You don't have to be specific, but are there police organizations that are going to bring you in soon to talk about this?
I cannot be specific about
that. Okay, you
that,
cannot. Yes. Well, I hope the answer is there's a lot of police organizations. and I say that again with love and respect for police organizations in our community.
Yes, definitely, yeah.
But this is hard stuff. And we're learning so much this hour with Shani Wilson, who is talking about compassion fatigue. Let me read an email from Amy, who I admit I read this email and at first I thought, what? And then I stopped for a second and I said, I totally get it. She says, I'm surprised that veterinarians have not been mentioned in a discussion about compassion fatigue.
Ooh, yes,
and at first
definitely.
I was thinking, what? And then I thought, just last year, had to have two cats put down.
Yeah.
That was hard enough for me. And then I'm thinking, you know, the person who's there, first of all, they're administering the medication that ends an animal's life. They're seeing people crying. You probably get into a veterinary profession because you love animals. Yeah, I think so.
Right. Yeah.
So much love to our friends in the veterinary business.
That's right.
That's probably right here.
Helper professions, right? The people that are actually, they are giving out care and they are in charge of a life. And that is so difficult. You're absolutely right.
So Amy, I think you're on the money there, and and that's got to be very difficult too. So I hope people who work in veterinary offices are, again, taking time for themselves, you know, not taking time off when you feel like you need it, or frankly, just when you want it. I think that's great. I also wanted to ask you about teachers, and every teacher I know has had a student or two who, you know, their circumstances were heartbreaking. Now, if you're in a district that has high levels of poverty, socioeconomic inequality, it may be a lot more than one or two.
Right.
And I worry about teachers because you know, they're in charge of our kids and they're doing amazing work. But when you see a child going home and you're wondering, you know, are they sleeping on someone's couch tonight? Do they have a place to go? Do mm-hmm. they have food? Are they safe?
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine what teachers must go through with that.
That's right. So, and so think about it, especially, you know, you are trained to do one thing, which is be a teacher, right? But you actually are doing the job. You're doing five different jobs. You know, you're the social worker, you're the teacher, you're the coach, you're the psychologist, psychiatrist, and you're, you know, the, you know, taking care of the family members. You're walking a person home to make sure that they eat. You're making sure that they come in and they look okay. You're constantly worried about somebody. And it gets to the point where you are having issues with hypervigilance, where you're just constantly worried about the students and how you're going to go home. And so a lot of times too, you know, especially with the population that we have in Rochester, it really gets to be really cumbersome. And I know a lot of teachers that I know really struggle with a lot of anxiety and depression, and also just, you know, a lot of issues with fear. So, yeah, like a lot of fear, especially like being in some of these situations where they don't feel safe. Like if they're having issues with like a student becoming violent or having some sort of violent outburst because of stuff that's going on at home.
And think about all the layers there. I mean, I'm pretty comfortable saying that if a student is violent with a teacher in class, that student's experienced some kind of trauma. Most
right.
people are not just going to assault a teacher.
Right.
And if you're a teacher, you know that. You may know that they're going through some really heavy, difficult stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any message you would send to school districts or teachers in particular about dealing with compassion fatigue?
So sending message to teachers.
Just
so I would
understanding it yeah. and kind of mitigating or dealing with it.
Yeah, honestly, I think that is such a huge problem. I don't really have an answer except to just say, you know, there is going to be, you know, they are the most important people in, you know, raising children and, you know, doing the best that they can with what they have. And I think that they need to be celebrated. I think that the teachers in this town are doing a fantastic job, but I think that they are at a point where there's just not enough. There's not enough of them. There's not enough resources for them. There's not enough resources for kids, especially those with mental illness. And there's like a bunch of things that has to change in order for them to be comfortable. So, you know, I would just encourage teachers to make sure that they are seeing a therapist, make sure that they're seeing a therapist pretty, I would say once a week is what I tell my patients if they're having problems, if I see teachers. And to make sure that they're getting the support that they can outside of the classroom and also with their friends.
Yesterday on this program, we had Sheriff Todd Baxter talking about solitary confinement and the debate in this state about changing the laws and the rules about how much is too much. Hmm. I think about prison staff. I think about people in those kind of settings where, I mean, the more you think about compassion fatigue, the more you can find places and professions that would be at risk for it. And I think we've learned a lot this hour. So what have we missed, Shani? I mean, what do we need to take with us from this hour as we try to understand it?
So I would say, you know, I always look at my own life and just about how I've had to decide what are some things that I've really wanted for myself. You know, as a woman, as a, you know, woman of color, as a healthcare provider. And I think that at the end of the day, it is really about my own ideas about what I need. You know, as much as I would like for my organization or other organizations to, you know, that people might work for to, you know, put me first, I have to put me first. And I have to make my own self-care needs known. And, you know, that's at least the first step. And then if they're not acknowledging your needs after that, then that's something different. But I still have to recognize, and it was really a hard thing to wrestle with, but I need to recognize that there are certain things that I can do, and then there's certain things that I cannot. And if it comes to a point where I am detaching from my job and from my life, then I really need to take a step back and figure out what needs to change.
Does it help to have people in your close circle, friends and family, who have a good understanding of how difficult mentally the work can be?
Definitely, yes. Yes, it is. And I think that, you know, all of those conversations to spur you on to make a good decision for yourself and to be confident in your decision. So all of these, all of our training has gotten to us to where we are now, and our caregiving and our empathy has gotten us to where we are now with the people around us that we care for. It's just taking it to the next step to say, I need this now. And that's got to be okay.
Yeah, I'll close with this thought, because I think this is so relatable when you say, you know, you certainly hope that employers will look out for employees, and,
right.
and but you gotta advocate for yourself, especially if you know you're at a point. I hope we're getting better as a society with that. And that's not right. to say for all the employers or people might be worried that, well, this is just going to open the floodgates, people
right,
taking
exactly.
advantage of it.
No.
I'm more concerned with whether we're being truly compassionate to employees and giving them the space they need, not just for them, but for the people they work with and serve.
Right.
Are we getting any better?
I would say yes. In some organizations, yes, because they realize that there is a productivity issue because people are just tired. So I think there's a long way to go, but there's definitely some progress in some organizations.
If you're interested in a training, in a conversation with Shawnee Wilson, who leads trainings to help recognize and understand compassion fatigue and how it could impact the work that you do, the organization you work with, good idea to get in touch with her. swilson9@gmail.com if you want to get in touch. And we're really glad to have this conversation. Thank you for the work that you do and for educating us this hour. Thank you, Shawnee.
Thank you, Evan.
Our thanks to David Griffin. David is the volunteer behind the glass. Thank you, David. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, Megan Max, the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you're surrounded by love this afternoon, and we'll talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.